It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome back to Money for Lunch. I'm just going to jump into the quote of the day. The quote of the day brought to you today by our good friends at Texas Roadhouse, over 400 locations nationwide. Great food, great steaks, great people. Great works are performed not by strength, but by perseverance. And that's by Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson. Great works are performed not by strength, but by perseverance. Absolutely. A lot to be said about willing to persevere. Today on the show, we have Norm Blumenthal, an attorney for workers and consumers, selected as one of the top attorneys in Southern California in 2017. Norm was inducted and recognized as one of America's most trusted lawyers in employment law. Norm Blumenthal is a regular contributor here on Money for Lunch, and he doesn't mind telling you how it is. Norm Blumenthal, welcome back.
Good. Nice to be here, Bert. It's always good to be back to Money for Lunch. And yeah, I wanted to start the show off today with, like we try to do, with things you're not going to hear on regular TV or regular radio, things that were provocative for people to give them a little more understanding of where they are. I think a term that now we're hearing thrown around with no one with a clear understanding of what it is socialism. And you're going to hear that, it looks like now, between now and the end of the election, there's some good things to socialism and there's some bad things to socialism. And first, let's talk about the bad things. The idea of socialism itself is the government takeover of business. And that's what you've seen in Venezuela. It's a failed state where they took over all the oil companies, the distribution companies, the agricultural companies, and look what ended up happening. It was a failed system in Russia. You saw it fail there, and they had to give up on it. And it was actually a failed system in China, where they had to give up on it and go to a free market system. So that's one definition of socialism that no one wants, which is the government takeover of business and the control of it. So, and that's not what the Democrats are talking about, any stretch of the imagination. The socialism they're talking about, I guess we would call it socialism light, is maybe what we'll call it. And socialism light is really what we have in this country, starting with Social Security. Passed by President Roosevelt in the 40s, which was safety nets. That's socialism light. There's safety nets all around us to protect people. Unemployment insurance is a safety net. Social Security is a safety net. Medicare is a safety net. This is the idea, and the question that has to be decided is, to what extent you want your safety nets in place. Democrats tend to want more safety nets for people and protection, and Republicans tend to want less safety nets for people. But at the end of the day, no one wants to get rid of our capitalist system, because capitalism is a beautiful economic system. It gives you the right to fail. And that's an important thing. That you can, you know, get up and, as you said at the beginning from Samuel Johnson, to persevere, to get up, to fail, dust yourself off and try again and try to succeed, to better yourself and your family better than others may be able to do. Because you don't want a country where everything is under the lowest common denominator. Those economies have all failed. And communism's failed, and pure socialism, government takeover of business, has failed. But the safety net, the issue of how much of a safety net you want to have is what we're talking about. And so keep that in mind moving forward. We'll talk about that more. I want to move on to talk about Trump, if we could, about our imperial president.
Sure. And I want to talk about his latest emergency, what do you call it?
Emergency declaration.
Thank you.
And This is what we fought the revolution about. There was an imperial democracy in England run by the king. And the king in England had the ultimate authority. And whatever the king ultimately said went. But if the king didn't act on it, then the people were free to implement laws as long as the king liked them. So the king had what we call unlimited veto power in England over everything. And it was veto power over the colonies and the Americans, of course, and everything that happened here. And we got sick of it, and we overthrew him and kicked him out in the American Revolution. And we put in what's called a constitutional democracy, where we have a president. Now, the president, he cannot make the laws. He can only implement the laws. And he has a veto power over laws that may be passed by Congress, but ultimately he doesn't have veto power over the Constitution. And in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, is the power of the purse, of Congress has that, to decide where money is going to be spent. And if you give the president the veto power over where the money is going to be spent in terms of, well, I'm going to take money from one pocket and put it into another, you have basically created an imperial presidency. And that this is really what we're talking about. This is ultimately the danger of what's happening here because, for example, what Trump has done is in his imperial presidency, he's decided that the money that was allocated, for example, for the SEALs to build new facilities in San Diego, Coronado, $408 million, he's going to take all that money to build his ego wall, crossing a couple miles, and put his name on it, Trump's Wall. This is what we're going to have. And, you know, and then he's taking money from the military to build housing in Kentucky for our soldiers and their families, and he's going to use that to build maybe another couple miles of his ego wall on the border. But more important is the idea that we have an imperial presidency like this, and that the only way that Congress can stop him from these emergency orders of our imperial president is to pass a law saying, no, 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 you can't do this, to which is veto-proof. So we've put in some law back in the 70s, which I think is unconstitutional, where the president can theoretically do this and change where the money's going to be spent, and Congress can't revise it without overcoming his veto, which makes him an imperial president. So that's what really where the rubber meets the road. Are we going to have an imperial presidency, or are we going to continue with the constitutional democracy? The Republicans are sold out on Trump, and they're whatever he says goes. So it's ultimately going to end up in the court, and I think it's going to be 9-0 that we have a constitutional democracy and not an imperial presidency.
Yeah, I think it's it's first of all, it's interesting. Just watching this stuff unfold to me is so it just blows my mind. It's almost like a reality TV show. You just can't make this stuff up.
You can't. You really can't, because you have somebody in here who has no concept of history, doesn't study it, doesn't read, just has concept of where he is right there and where his ego is, and it's frightening. Of who we're dealing with, and he's created this imperial presidency, and hopefully the courts are going to stop it. They'll stand up to it. I have great confidence in this court, in the people that are on this court, and I really feel like it's going to be such a clear decision that if you take away the allocation of funds that Congress places on spending on the executive branch, if you allow the presidency to reallocate funds, that is the beginning of the end of our democracy as we know it. because the president will ultimately be an imperial leader, just like the King of England was. And this will be something that, that we'll have to live with throughout whatever is going to happen. And you know, the Republicans should be in fear of this as the Democrats, because the Democrats get in and become president, and they're going to reallocate funds to whatever their needs are. You know, supposedly they decide for climate change that you're not going to be able to drive a car. No, can't sell gasoline in the country. I'm going to reallocate funds my emergency order is no sale of gasoline, close all the gas stations, and people have to figure out what they're going to do to get around. And crazy things like that. What are you going to do?
Yeah, the deal is, and this is the great thing about what we have here, there are checks and balances, but I like your point there that he does have to be reined in a little bit, and we've had in the past, speaking of history, we've had some presidents that have done some wild stuff, and again they were reined in, they were stopped, and so hopefully that'll happen here as well.
Yeah, I'm very confident that it will, and Trump is just in the end this is going to be another thing where he embarrasses himself. So we'll see that as it unfolds, but we'll keep track of it. But I just wanted to tell the audience out there, you know, that this is really a big deal. And this is something that we can't have presidents like this that don't have any respect for the Constitution. That's really what we have here. And it's a pretty scary thing. All right. So
go ahead.
I wanted to move into one other topic before we talk more about some employment law that we've talked about, is the student loan debt. I think I sent you a little article. This is something that's out there. There's $1 trillion now in student loan debt. And there's some answers that, of course, you won't hear anywhere else except on this show. There's legislation now that's been proposed in Congress to solve the student debt problem. And it solves it in the same way that health insurance works, which is anybody that works for somebody that hasn't a health insurance, the employer pays a share of the health insurance, but the employee does not pay taxes on that money. It's pre-tax, as everybody understands it. So the employer's share of health insurance is paid pre-tax to the insurance company to give the employee insurance. So I think everybody understands that and knows that they're not paying taxes on it. Well, in front of Congress now is a law, and hopefully it'll pass and get through the Senate and signed by the president, allowing the same concept, which is if you work for a company, the company can advertise, I want you to work for me. In return for you working for me, not only will you get your salary and your health benefits, but I will pay off your student loan with pre-tax funds for as long as you stay with the company at a certain amount, you know, each month. So now you're going to work for this company. It's another incentive for employees to work for a company, and it gives them more money in their pocket post-tax because they don't have to use post-tax dollars to pay off their student loans. So it's right. There's an answer, and hopefully it'll pass Congress soon. And we've been pushing this law for a while through my Congressman Scott Peters. We've been pushing it, and I think it'll eventually get to the floor now.
And okay, so talk about this. So you're saying that it would be pre-tax dollars. So again, not a taxable consequence to the employee. It helps them reduce their debt, and it's
That's
a
right.
tax write-off to the employer.
That's right. So
I
this,
like that.
This, yeah. So this $1 trillion in debt, and not only does it help. It helps the employee, it helps the employer, but it also helps the economy because now there's more money in the employee's pocket, where they can now go out because nobody can afford a down payment on the house anymore. And so they can save money to make a down payment to buy a place to live. And so you have employees now that are more settled in your community, where the employer has its facilities. They have more money to spend. They're buying houses. They're buying furniture. They're buying cars. There's more money in the economy. It keeps the economy moving. It's a real shot in the arm when you can pay off $1 trillion in debt over time with pre-tax dollars like this. So it's a win-win-win situation, and we've been pushing it now, you know, in the Congress, but we haven't had a Democratic Congress to get this to the floor of the Congress, but we're working on it. So I want all the folks out there that are listening with student debt, you know, there are answers to it, but the answers come from the Democrats. And that's why when you get out there, if you're a working stiff and you're going to vote, vote with your pocketbook. You know, think about what's best for you. There's laws like this that want to go on the books that help everybody, but it's not going to happen unless the Democrats are in the White House and control the Senate and the House of Representatives. This is just a preview of the good things that can happen for people when you have the Democrats in power. And talking about Democrats, you know, the Republicans want to point their finger at the, you know, the far end of it, which they're now calling socialists, and say, well, then, you know, be afraid they're going to take over everybody's business. This is not the kind of social compact that the Democrats want. You know, the Democrats want to do things that help business and help people at the same time. A win-win situation. This is really what we want to have. So we're working towards that.
And, yeah, I like, you know, that. You know what? You know what? The thing here is there are so many ways to solve these problems, right? And what I mean by that is, again, looking at the example with reducing this $1 trillion student loan debt, right? We're going to have the most encumbered, indebted graduates ever, right? And a simple solution can be worked out, but you and I have always talked about follow the money. So who is going to be, what do you call it, who benefits by this $1 trillion debt? Well, you know, believe it or not, some politicians do, the banks do, there's a lot of people that benefit. And so that's why we have $1 trillion worth of debt, you know, because too many people are benefiting from, putting all this debt around these young people. And what's interesting to me, Norm, is that you can look, you can do some research on Google, and supposedly there's, you know, like $1 billion available for grants and scholarships that literally go untapped every year. And the reason they go untapped every year is because since they don't benefit anybody, nobody can make money off these grants and these scholarships, they're not promoted. And so people don't know about it.
Yeah, the flip side of the coin is that like in California, community college is going to be free. I mean, it's virtually free now, but you can go your first 2 years of college for free. And if you maintain a B average or better, you can then get into a four-year college. And the goal here in California is to make higher education available to students without charge. That's the goal, because ultimately you have to have an educated workforce now. This is not going to be a workforce that's going to be labor-intensive. There'll be service personnel, of course, will still be working, but more and more the jobs that are going to be making the money are the people that continue to get their education through a four-year college and obtain a degree that has value to the system that we're in, where everything is digitized and basically you sit in an office and you can work around the world because of the interconnectivity of the economies that we have. But those that are prospering from it are those with a higher education. So California is leading the way and making sure everybody has an education without regard to their economic ability to pay. And that's important because we want to have an educated workforce here in California. We want to, in the United States, and you know, for around the world. This is where things go. People with education and working and making money are going to be a peaceful group. When goods cross borders, troops don't. And so this is where we're headed in an economy that is a working economy. And so, by the same token, we do have this $1 trillion in debt that the banks make money off of that we can get rid of and in a fair and reasonable manner and move forward then without the debt. Like you said, where there's you know, billions of dollars go to waste where in grants that aren't taken. Well, there needs to be a system to tap into those funds too. So
yeah,
that's where we're headed. But the economy today, the real thing we want to talk about today, now that we've covered kind of the current events, is the new Dynamex decision in California. This is the decision with regard to classifying persons as employees or independent contractors. And so let's see if we can set the stage for everybody so they understand the issues first. Okay, so if you're an employee, you get a paycheck, and your employer pays what's called the employer share of payroll taxes, which comes to about 15% of your paycheck. He also pays unemployment insurance for the employee. He pays Social Security for the employee and health insurance you talked about to the extent the company offers it. Okay. Now, that employee has all those benefits, and as a result of those benefits, the paycheck the employee receives what's taken out is something less than 100%. We all know that. We've all seen our paychecks, what comes out. On the other hand, if you're an independent contractor, you perform a service for a person. Let's make it as simple. You cut somebody's hair, for example, and you perform a service and you get paid credit card or cash, but you get paid, and there's no deductions for that. So you receive 100 cents on the dollar to start off with. But at the end of the day, if you're paying your taxes, you should be paying taxes. You pay, number one, self-employment tax, which equals the employer share of payroll taxes, Social Security taxes, unemployment insurance, all those things that the employer would otherwise pay, the independent contractor is supposed to pay. Does the independent contractor pay that? No. And there's no reporting of that money because anything under $600, there's no requirement to report it with a 1099. So the underground economy thrives without any reporting and without any taxes. And at the end of the day, who's going to foot the bill when these independent contractors need health care, emergency room care, Social Security, unemployment, food stamps, everything else that goes with it? They've been on a free ride all the way through, and then you and I, who are paying our taxes, both as employer and employee, we then, as a group, have to foot the bill. So the idea is, in Dynamex, which was a California Supreme Court decision, it changed the rules on classification of someone, whether they're an employee or an independent contractor. And it said, if you're performing work that is at the core of the company's business, i.e. Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Instacart, you know, all these companies that are thriving using independent contractors, if that's the core business of the company, they need to be reclassified as employees. And it's a huge decision in California, which follows the same decision in Massachusetts, which created what's called the ABC test. And I won't go into the nuts and bolts of it, but the bottom line is it has changed the playing field and the paradigm for classification of employee versus independent contractor. The reason being is try to even the playing field. So
right. So let me understand this real quick. We'll pick on Uber here. Uber has all these people who are working for them as an independent contractor under this California law, this California Supreme Court case you're talking about. That's no longer going to be available because that what they're saying is this case is basically saying, hey, you're basically building your entire business on independent contractors. And therefore, we're not going to allow it because what? I mean, are they saying because as an employee, I'm an independent contractor for Uber, you're basically limited? You're not really an independent contractor because you're not doing rides for anybody else?
No.
How does that play out?
That changed the test. Okay. That's the old test, which was the test with control. So you're on the right track because under the old test, it was control. Hey, I don't control this guy. He can work when he wants, comes and goes as he pleases, tells me when he wants to work, tells me when he doesn't want to work, go to work for Lyft at the same time, or DoorDash, whatever he wants to do. And so, therefore, he's an independent contractor. That's the old control test. No, what they said is the control test is no longer the test. It's one of the tests, but there's three tests, the ABC test, one of which is control. And it's an or test. If you satisfy any one of the three tests, then you're an employee. One of the or tests is, are you doing work for Uber, for example, which is core to their business? And Uber would argue, oh, no, we're not in the business of picking up people and taking them places. We're only in the business of we're an answering service. You know, we just, they call up and they want a car and we have people that want to give them a ride. And so we're just connecting them. That's all we do. And we don't have any cars of our own. So we're not in that business and we have no control over that business. Well, that's not going to work as well in the argument when there's a control, when there's a core business test. Wait a minute. You're telling me, Uber, that you're not in the business of delivering people from one destination to another? Isn't that your core business? That's what you advertise. So that's where the rubber meets the road, as we can say. And ultimately, the test is going to, if the core business test is followed, all of these persons who are now classified as independent contractors in California will have to be reclassified as employees. And they can still use their own car, and they would bill the, you know, mileage based on the mileage rates that are for various cars and the time they have, you know, using their car for Uber or using their car for Lyft and the hours that they put in. You know, it's going to be some type of piece rate system that it'll be. Okay, you work for me and make that delivery, and I pay you for for that delivery. On, you know, basically it's on piece rate service. So there's going to be a lot of legal work on for Uber's attorneys to figure out how to do this, but it's coming, and you know it'll probably be the way it's going to be in the rest of the country because at the end of the day, when all these Uber drivers, you know, they aren't paying their fair share of the taxes. You know, they've got literally a free ride because they're not paying employers, paying self-employment taxes, paying, they don't have any health insurance. They aren't paying Social Security. They aren't paying unemployment. And at the end of the day, we have this vast economy that's an underground economy, where it's good for the people in the underground, but ultimately it's not going to be good for all of us in general because the rest of us are going to have to foot the bill for the underground economy. So that's where the dynamics come in as to how and in what way they're going to have to classify these gig economy persons working now as all as independent contractors.
Yeah, that, you know what? It's going to be interesting, and I can see both sides of the argument, right? Hey, we're really not a taxi service, right? And I think that obviously, that's going to be an interesting situation there. But I could see, again, I can see the state saying, hey, you know what, you really are in the, first of all, you really are in the taxi business, for lack of better terms. That is what Uber is known for, right? They're not known as an answering service. They're really known as, hey, Uber will pick you up, take you wherever you want, whatever. You don't say, hey, an Uber independent contractor is going to pick me up, right? And what's interesting, too, because I've used Uber quite a bit, and I think they changed this. But for a while there, Norm, if you had a favorite Uber driver, you could not request that favorite Uber driver. So that right. whole independence thing is definitely shaky, and I don't know if they've changed that. But my point being is that you can see where a state would come in and say, hey, you know, we just want to make sure that these employees aren't carrying the burden that the employer should carry, is essentially
right.
what they're trying to say.
And yeah, the state's going to want their cut. I mean, we know, you know,
right.
they look, they build the roads, they supply the traffic control. They, you know, if there's an accident, they send the police. I mean, all these services that we provide through taxes, the state's going to want a cut of that. And so the question is, and it's not an easy question, but there's got to be a win-win situation. Just like we were able to solve the student debt problem, this is solvable. I mean, maybe there's a piece of every ride. Maybe it's piece rate. A piece of every ride has to go to the state to cover, you know, taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe Uber needs to pay a piece to the state for every ride to cover their, you know, share of it. And then a piece has to go to the driver to cover his cost, obviously, of his car and the maintenance of it to make it viable for him. And then there has to be a fair living wage for the driver for doing the work. So there's a lot of dynamics that goes into this, but the idea that, you know, just using the old Wild Wild West thing, oh, he's an independent contractor, let's not think about it, those days are over. I mean, people are not going to buy cars anymore. Anyway, they're just going to use Uber and Lyft, and it's not going to go away, but there has to be a change in the dynamics, and there's probably going to be an increase in cost. I mean, Uber, compared to taxis, we all know, are just substantially less. And at the end of the day, the price is going to have to go up to cover all of these costs, and at the same time to allow Uber to deliver and Lyft to deliver the services that they deliver now, and the driver to make his same, you know, fair living wage. It's got to be able to do that. So that's where we have to make it come in.
Hey, you cut out. Where'd you go?
Oh, that's
right. There
I'm
you
back.
Are.
Yeah, I'm back. So that's where we are. So we don't have the answers yet, but I'm sure we're going to get some good ones on it. So that's something for everybody to think about.
No, absolutely. It's interesting how the stuff rolls out. It's interesting how somebody can make a change, and that's what you're doing there by contacting your I think you said congressman to try to, you know, get some of these things and make a difference. So first of all, especially I think in a place like California, because California is unique in the sense that it has initiatives that a layperson can actually get going and build a grassroots following with and make some changes there that a lot of states don't have. So, you know, one person can make a difference. That's number one. And number two, we've always talked about following the money. And number three, we've always talked about voting with your pocketbook like everybody else does.
That's exactly right. And you know, California, this is a very blue state, and we have a lot of concern for the worker. And we want him to have a living wage. And at the same time, we have to have enough money to run the state to make it viable, too. So
yeah.
we're working on it out here, and the rest of the country, you know, I think it's going to be state by state. We've increased our minimum wage. It's heading to $15 through most of the state now. And the economy's booming. We're the fifth largest economy in the world now, California. And that's no accident, because the money is moving in California. You need to put the money not in the hands of the millionaires and billionaires. You need to put it in the hands of the working stiff so he can spend it, because he's the guy that's going to ultimately go out there and spend it every day.
Yes, sir. I like it. Norm Blumenthal, good to have you here. Appreciate you keeping us abreast of what's happening, and looking forward to having you back again real soon.
Sure, it'd be great, Bert. Look forward to being there. And everybody out there, just have a great day and be safe.
All righty. Good stuff there from Norm Blumenthal. Norm Blumenthal, an attorney for workers and consumers. He's also a regular contributor here on Money for Lunch. As always, my friends, let's share this episode with everyone you know. And as always, my friends, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.